I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's show, we're going to listen to three stories about raising kids. We'll hear from Ron Fournier about his experiences as the parent of a child with Asperger's syndrome. His book, Love That Boy, is about bonding with his son and learning to be a better father. We'll also hear about how kids learn from their toys and the importance of play. Our guests are psychology professor Kathy Hirsch-Pasek and researcher Anna Sosa. But first, we'll learn about the inner workings of the teenage brain and how parents can best handle their behavior. Our guest is University of Pennsylvania neuroscientist Frances Jensen. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. On the show, we're going to listen to three conversations about raising children, and we'll begin with one of the most difficult periods of life, the teenage years. As kids go from childhood to adolescence, not only are their bodies changing, so are their minds and behavior. They become interested in sex and flirting with rebellion. This, of course, is a challenge for parents, striking a balance between giving them some freedom and wanting to keep them safe. We discussed the mind of the teenager when we were joined by University of Pennsylvania neuroscientist Frances Jensen, author of The Teenage Brain, A Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Let's listen. So if we could use time-lapse photography and take a teenage brain and start the photographs, let's say when they're 12 or 13 years old, starting puberty, into, let's say, mid-20s, what changes would we see over that time period?
Thanks to advanced imaging, we can look at brain connectivity using something called functional MRI and diffusion tensor imaging to look at the connections from parts of the brain from one side to the other. And actually, a group from NIH has done this. They took kids and did these functional MRIs every year from the age of like 5 to 20. And you see this. And what do we see changing? Well, first of all, the brain connects itself over time from the back to the front. And the last place to fully connect with high-speed connections, that process takes 2.5 decades to complete. So the last place to connect up fully for fast split-second connectivity is the frontal lobe. So, you know, you're going to smile because what does the frontal lobe do? It's insight, judgment, executive function. And that's just not done yet with teenagers.
So how does it then help us understand just teenagers? If that's their brain, what does that tell us about them?
Yes, the fact that they are not connecting their frontal lobes up, the different regions of your brain subserve lots of different functions, right? Your emotional centers are actually back a ways, sort of behind your ears, sort of where our earphones are right now. So they're behind. They actually get connected up a little sooner than your frontal lobes. So what happens is teenagers are very prone to the influences of their emotional systems, their limbic systems, without the regulation of the frontal lobe. But the frontal lobe is saying, wait, don't control this impulse. Mm-hmm. This is not a good idea. There's a cause and there's an effect, you know, put the two together, reason. And they can reason. It's not like teenagers don't have a frontal lobe. It's not empty up there, but it is not connected with high-speed connections yet. So when they're in a split second under a lot of pressure, they won't necessarily use the same judgment that we enjoy as adults.
You write about an oversupply of neurons and then, I guess, undersupply of white matter. Translate what you mean by that for us.
Yes. So that was what I just alluded to. That's the second part of this story, of the big two differences of the teenage brain, to kind of sum it up. So, as I said, the brain's the last organ in the body to mature. It takes till your mid-20s. And this connection from region to region is a big part of that story. And that connection, we call it white matter. You have gray matter, where all the neurons are, which is sort of the outside mantle of your brain underneath your skull. But underneath that, those brain cells are sending processes from one side of the brain to the other, down to the spinal cord. They're insulated with something called myelin, which looks white. That's why we call it white matter. The development of this white matter, this connection structure, is the thing that takes a very long time. But the gray matter, which has all the neurons in, is a very different story. There, the teenagers actually have a significant advantage over adults. They have more brain cells and actually more synapses, which are where two brain cells talk to each other. They connect by a synapse, and they have more of those. Interestingly, when we learn, What we do is we repeatedly use a circuit of a couple of brain cells talking to each other via a synapse. And the more you use it, the bigger the synapse grows. So now that synapse is stronger, and that's what we call memory. So actually, teenagers have more synapses. They have more machinery to build the synapse so that they can learn things much more easily. They don't have to practice 25 times like an adult. They can get their learning in two or three times. Children are even better. So the synapse is, you know, we call it synaptic plasticity. It's coming down from childhood, but the adolescents definitely have more of it than adults.
It's so easy to think about teenagers and all the, you know, the challenging and risky things they do. But there are so many wonderful things about teenagers as well. Does the brain help us understand that as well?
Yes.
I'm thinking in terms of creativity, for instance.
Exactly. So a lot of this relates to this term I just used, synaptic plasticity, which means that your brain connections, your synapses, are plastic. They're molded by experience. It's the more you use them, the greater and bigger they get, more of your brain area that is given over to a certain task or a data set is built larger if you use it. So that's actually what's happening. Teenagers actually can learn faster, harder, stronger, longer than adults. Did you know that your IQ can change in your teenage years?
Well, I didn't know until I read your book, but yes.
And that is an example of it's a golden age. It's a time that kids can really use to scaffold their brain. And I think one of the things I tried to point out in the book and in whenever I'm talking about this topic is that I think we should think about this as a real window of opportunity for curriculum development and the educational, social development. They can change. And you know what? If you start your teens one way, it doesn't mean you have to end that way.
If we're raising teenagers, is it important to tell them about their brain? I mean, to say, this is why you might be doing something like this. This is why you're smoking cigarettes. This is why you're staying up till 2 in the morning, know that you have to get up at 7:30 to go to school.
This is a huge point. You have to realize that this is very new research. So research on the early development and on the aging brain is much further along than research on the teen brain. And yes, I think that it should be taught to them in schools. I think they should be made aware that they are more vulnerable to risk taking. We'll talk about some other vulnerabilities too, but that they also have this hidden strength that I think hasn't been really appreciated by society at large, that this is sort of a time that they can really scaffold their brain and, you know, be very mindful. They have one brain. It's not getting any bigger, and they're not really building any new brain cells. They're really having to work with what they make during this late teen, early adult period. It's scaffolding it for the future. What they lay down there will allow them to do more learning in certain areas in later life. And they can learn faster, so they can acquire more knowledge, like a language, now versus an adult.
You mentioned risk-taking, and I think we can, if we remember our own adolescence or no adolescence, there is a time when many of them do take risks. I mean, is it about seeking something new, experiencing something that they've never experienced before?
Yeah, so this particular stage in life is one where there's a lot of self-exploration, trying to understand one's identity, and a lot of novelty-seeking behavior, which we all have, but we also couple that with impulse control as adults. And by not having that frontal lobe really there to say, don't take this risk, it's clear that this has got to be one of the major explanations for why teenagers are such risk takers. Mm. We know that they're risk takers, but I think by telling them explicitly that you have this weakness. But let's listen to some stories where people just like you had something happen because they didn't think through it.
I do want to talk about addiction, something that you write about in the book, and why young people seem to be vulnerable to overdoing it when it comes to drinking or drugs or even smoking cigarettes. Is there something about the teenage brain that can explain that to us?
Yes. So remember when I said the teen brain is a learning brain? It's much more able to learn. It has better synaptic plasticity. It can build synapses much more easily to learn a fact or a skill than an adult. Well, it turns out that addiction is actually a form of learning. It uses the same mechanism. So instead of a fact or a practice, it's a drug that you're repeatedly, stimulating yourself with. And just like a fact, you learn, your pathway gets stronger and stronger. Your reward pathway gets stronger and stronger in your reward circuits in your brain. And unfortunately, it becomes hardwired much faster. Just like a fact that is memorized can be hardwired in a brain in a teenager much faster, so can a bad thing like addiction. So they get addicted harder, stronger, longer, faster as than an adult. And this is a huge vulnerability because, of course, they're more taking risks. And
sure.
Then, of course, with the internet and social networking, some of these things come so easily to them that they really are, it's just like a perfect storm.
If that's true, and I don't doubt it, then how does someone intervene? If you have a teenager who smokes cigarettes, I mean, I smoke cigarettes as a teenager, or is abusing drugs or alcohol, as a parent or an adult, how do you intervene under those circumstances?
I think you have to do a lot of explaining and a lot of vigilance. It is definitely something to try to avoid. Try to avoid seeing your child get addicted. That is as a teenager, it is a much more serious illness than it will be, than it would even be in an adult. Addiction is terrible at all windows. But because it happens in the teenage brain, it actually changes the way the brain continues to develop.
Wow.
And therefore, they will be addicted lifelong, and it's so much harder for them to quit than an adult.
As we know, marijuana is becoming more available. I mean, there's states where obviously there's medical marijuana, a couple of states where there's now recreational marijuana. Does that concern you when it comes to teenagers?
It does very much, actually. I know it, you know, even in states where it's been legalized, it's not legal for somebody 18 to use the drug, but it'll be around and it'll be accessible. The problem is that actually in through your early 20s, cannabis has a long-lasting effect on your brain development. First of all, it has a long-lasting effect in the moment. Instead of people getting high and then it wears off within hours, in the teen brain, it can be there for days. And remember I told you about learning? They're like learning brains, the synaptic plasticity. It blocks that process. So their learning is impaired for days after getting high. Chronic pot smoking, day after day, through between 13 and 17, again, this is what I put in the book, a study, shown that it can drop your IQ in what we call a dose-dependent fashion. So the more you smoke, the further your IQ drops. And remember I said that there's so much synaptic plasticity at this wonderful age in development that unfortunately you can tune it up, you can tune your IQ up, or you can actually have negative things make it go down. You're still very malleable. So it doesn't only mean that you can, you know, it only goes one way. So unfortunately, cannabis, there's actually a fair amount of information now showing that it does decrease IQ in a dose-dependent way permanently. You can't get that back. You cannot get that back.
Would you, I mean, what about alcohol? And I mean, there's a lot of binge drinking when it comes to college, for instance.
Yes. So the deal with alcohol is not too different. First of all, if you look in the moment, what is alcohol doing to the synapse? It is preventing that growth of the synapse to learn. It will prevent that set of, you know, molecular events. So once again, alcohol is going to affect learning and memory. We kind of know that, right?
Right.
It also makes you disinhibited. Well, let's just think about this. Teenagers have less inhibition to start with because their frontal lobes aren't on a split-second, connection pattern with like adults. So they're going to get disinhibited even faster and possibly do even more risky things. So that's number two.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is that binge drinking, because they actually have more synapses around than the adult, binge drinking for a given amount of blood alcohol level that would be make an adult intoxicated, you actually get brain cell death in the teenager with a binge drinking episode. So there is more harm done. And this actually is one of the myths, for instance, to debunk. One of the reasons for getting this information out is to debunk myths because people think, oh, they're resilient. They'll bounce back. He had a bender. He'll sleep it off. We'll see him tomorrow morning. You know, no, they are actually suffering more damage. And that's a message that I think needs to be considered by young people.
That was my 2015 conversation with University of Pennsylvania neuroscientist Frances Jensen, author of The Teenage Brain. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about how kids learn from their toys. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Coane. Are new toys with their loud sounds and flashing lights helping our children learn? Are they any more or less educational than blocks and Legos? And what about iPads and other screens that are so ubiquitous these days?
We continue our look at child rearing by exploring this topic with two experts on the matter. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek is a faculty fellow in the psychology department at Temple University, and Anna Sosa is an associate professor of communication sciences and disorders at North Arizona University, also the director of their child speech and language lab. We discuss how toys affect brain development and how they can foster a healthy parent-child relationship. Let's listen. And I do want to begin with you. What were you looking to understand in doing this study?
Really, I just wanted to see how different everyday interactions that parents and babies occur, how that influences the communication between the parents and the babies.
And we're talking about three sets of toys. What were the toys that were part of this experiment?
Right. So to start looking at this, I chose toys. There's obviously lots of different everyday activities that occur, but we decided to focus on toys to start with. And so we decided to look at electronic toys. So these are toys that light up or beep or flash or make noises when a child pushes a button. We wanted to see what parents and babies did in interaction with those toys versus traditional toys. I'm calling traditional toys things like blocks. We use stacking blocks, shape sorters, and big chunky puzzles that are designed for babies in this age. And then I was also curious about how using books, reading with babies, compares to these different types of toys, since parents of infants from birth are often encouraged to read to their infants. So I was interested to see how these different interactions compared.
And how old were the babies in this study?
So at the time of data collection, the babies were between 10 and 16 months.
And interestingly, this was research that was done in the home in 15-minute increments, and there were audio recordings. So that it wasn't that you were observing these people. You were actually listening, I guess, to the audio recordings.
Exactly. So we only had the audio recording to go on, so we could really only analyze the verbal interactions. There's a lot of other stuff, nonverbal, going on that right. We weren't able to look at. But we did record in the home, and we really wanted to do that to try and make it more naturalistic, to see when parents and babies are playing in their usual setting with the usual distractions, dogs in the background, other siblings coming and going, what's going on during those times as opposed to in a more observed laboratory setting.
And what did you find?
Really consistent results, which is what I was surprised about. So in general, the parents talked a lot more. We were really looking more at what the parents were doing than what the babies were doing. So we were focusing on the language input and the verbal behavior that the babies were getting from their parents. And we found across the board that play with the electronic toys resulted in decreased numbers of words, just in general. We also looked at different types of words. So we selected toys in all the categories that were designed to elicit words in specific categories. So we looked at toys that could elicit animal names, colors, and shapes. And so we counted how many times a parent actually said one of those words. So did they say, oh, look, there's a piggy, or it's red? And again, in the electronic toy condition, they produced a lot fewer of those types of words.
So that's the main takeaway, that when looking at these three categories of toys, when it involves an electronic toy, there are less words coming out of the parent's mouth.
So the strongest findings were in the quantity measures. I'm very strong as far as just across the board, how many more words the parents were producing in the books. And I should say that we also were interested in the differences between books and traditional toys. So
right.
Are books that much better than traditional toys? And in some of the quantitative measures, there were big differences between the traditional toys and the books. We also looked at some more qualitative measures of the parent-child interaction, so how responsive the parent was to the baby. So most of these babies were not actually producing words. They're in the pre-linguistic. They're babbling. And so we were looking at when a baby did vocalize or babble, did the parent respond contingently to them? And again, we only could listen for verbal responses, not nonverbal responses. And we found that in the book and traditional play conditions, they were more responsive to their baby's verbalizations or vocalizations than they were in the electronic toy condition also.
Kathy, let me get you in on the conversation.
Well, hi, guys.
Any surprises here from these findings?
No, it's a lovely study. Congratulations. That it was really, really nice. No, we actually have research that's fairly consistent with this. One was with the electronic shape sorters. And Jen Zosh was the lead author on this paper, and we watched as parents were with their children trying to fit the squares in the square hole and the triangles in the triangle hole. And what did we find when you looked at traditional shape sorters versus, you know, these electronic, more digital, is that the toy is always talking for you, and it's taking over in the conversation. We actually, in that study, did not see a difference in the amount of language, but in the kind of language.
How so?
So what happens is the parents tend to either not say the names of the shapes, which is very consistent, because why should they? The toy's already saying shape. We're saying square. So why bother taking over for the toy when it's blabbing? But more importantly, the parents were more directive and less conversational. So they would say, put that here, shove it into this hole, instead of asking more questions. Well, where do you think this goes? We found very similar findings when we looked at children reading. So there it's quite consistent again. When you have an electronic kind of book, the parents are talking less and they're giving more commands. Don't push that. Turn the page, as opposed to really going beyond the words in the book to create a conversation.
And is that because maybe from the parent's perspective, I mean, a child that's 10 months old doesn't really have an opinion about an e-book or a regular book. From the parent's perspective, they see this device or this toy, in a sense, doing their job for them?
Well, in our studies, the children were 3 and 4.
A little older.
So they were a little bit older, and that does make a difference. So, you know, the parents could have a choice. And I think in our minds as parents sometimes, we do let the toys substitute for what we're going to do instead of supplementing what we're doing with the toy and with the child.
But let's take a pile of blocks. I mean, should parents be talking with their children about how to build a wall or just let the child figure this out? I realize we're talking many ways about language development, but does that mean a parent has to talk to their child through every toy activity?
Well, no, a parent doesn't have to speak with a child all the time, nor does a toy. And I think the point here is to try to create situations where parents and children have conversations. And let's take your block example.
Sure.
Because we actually had a study on that as well. And when you have parents and children playing with blocks, when the kid is playing alone, they do beautiful things, and free play alone is really important, especially in a digital world that we live in. But when the parent's around and doing the supplement, not substitute, and not intruding, they actually, with blocks, use more spatial terms, like put the blue one on top of the red. Or can you make this go through this? Or let's turn the yellow one. And when you use those kinds of terms, like around, through, in, out, middle, you're actually building spatial information. And it turns out that spatial knowledge is not only important for later architects, but also for later mathematicians.
Oh, interesting. Anna, let me go back to you, because looking at even the title of your study has to do with what you talk about is the quantity and also the quality of this parent-infant communication. What is the takeaway from your study then?
Well, I guess you should start with what my motivation for doing this study was, which is I am a speech-language pathologist and I work with families of young children, children as young as 10 months who have communication disorders or are at risk for. And I, about 3 years ago, I actually had a family asked me, say, you know, I've seen these toys that are advertised as teaching language to babies this young, and should I buy them? Should I have these available for my child? Will this help? And yeah, certainly I had my, you know, my instinct of what I wanted to say.
Sure.
I didn't have a lot of evidence to base it on. And subsequently, I had a student, a former student, call and pretty much ask me the same thing that a parent had asked her. She was working in early intervention. And I said, you know what? I want to know, what is the difference? What do parents do in this interaction? What types of interactions build the most, you know, the optimal language interaction? And based on the results of the study, my takeaway is I can now safely tell that parent, or confidently tell that parent, don't bother. Don't buy those toys. The time that you do have available to spend one-on-one playing with your child, focus on other types of interactions. And I can recommend traditional toys, blocks, things like that. And on the other hand, I've also had parents of very young babies or very young toddlers say, I've heard over and over again, I need to read to my child. I should be reading to my child. But for whatever reason, either they're not comfortable with it or their child doesn't particularly enjoy that activity at this age. They crawl away, they'll spend a couple minutes, but then they're not interested. I feel I can now confidently tell those parents, play with blocks. If they're not interested in reading, do a little bit of that, and then feel comfortable that you can provide a wonderful quality language interaction playing with blocks and other types of toys also.
Kathy, let me go back to you. I know the American Academy of Pediatrics said no screen time until for children under the age of two. But I have seen toddlers, and they see their mom or dad's cell phone, and their face lights up. We have about a minute before our first break here. What do you suggest to a parent?
Oh, Marty, it's such digital candy.
But it of is course, digital candy.
Our children are very attracted to dessert, too, and we don't let them eat the dessert instead of having the nutritious meal. So, you know, let's just look at the numbers for one sec. 70% of children 0 to 4 now have a tablet. 50% of children under 1 are playing with the tablet every day. 65% of parents are using some of these as babysitters. As parents, I think we just have to find the balance. It's not that these things are horrible. They have many wonderful features, but we also have to be careful how we use it. The same way we have to be careful with dessert.
And also, going back to Anna's study, sort of understanding perhaps maybe even listening to oneself, how one interacts with a child when there are different kinds of toys.
Well, it's all about the conversational duet, the back and forth, the singing it together. That's what breeds good language.
And that is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's a faculty fellow, the Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Psychology Department at Temple University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also with us, Anna Sosa, director of the NAU, that's the Northern Arizona University Child Speech and Language Lab. And we've been talking about a study she did looking at children and different kinds of toys published in JAMA. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In this hour of the show, we are talking about children, language acquisition, toys, the roles that parents play, the role that toys play as well. And again, our guests are Anna Sosa and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kathy, just a slight correction. I want you to make something I said that was not exactly correct, and we like to be correct on Radio Times.
All right, you got it.
It's important.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics did do a revision. Look, we live in a digital world. When you're at a point that three-quarters of children 0 to 4 have tablets, I think you have to get to the reality, as it were, that we're living digital. So now they're recommending balance as opposed to an absolute no screen time before 2.
And balance, I mean, that can mean different things to different people.
Yeah, well, it can. And I don't know that there really is an absolute. And right now, I think we're living in the kind of wild west of the digital times where people are putting out new products constantly. And I think that we'll come to a point, as we did in educational television, where we'll better understand how we can substitute what we do and supplement what we do with digital, as opposed to substituting or getting fixated on it.
Speaking of educational television, I'm thinking of Sesame Street, and this feels almost old-fashioned, you know, in the days
of apps
and cell phones. But nonetheless, to you, Anna, is this sort of along the same lines as television? I'm thinking of, you know, Teletubbies, Sesame Street, and some of the other so-called educational programs on public television. Are the findings applicable when it comes to television?
I'm not sure that they are directly applicable, because this was, really asking the parents to sit down with their child and play one-on-one. So this is sort of the optimum playtime or experience that is recommended by the American Academy of Pediatricians and such, that, you know, we should spend as much time as possible playing. And so this isn't, the study wasn't looking at just letting the child play independently with various types of toys, but really even in the sort of optimal child parent down on the floor playing with the child, what are the parents doing?
Such an important question. And Kathy, another thing that you are an expert in is the importance of play mm-hmm. for children. I mean, I guess, imaginative play? You mentioned the blocks, the importance of what you can learn from building blocks.
Well, there's just a lot that you can learn from different kinds of play, and there are many different kinds of play. You know, object play when we're playing with blocks, or when we put on masks and we become Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. We're doing a kind of pretend play. And there we learn to take on different roles, and we learn social skills. So sometimes free play is just great for free play, because we're trying to figure out how high we can build a tower before it falls down. We're being little physicists. And sometimes play can be more guided with adults. And with that, the child still takes the lead. Mm-hmm. But the adult is there in a supporting role. And when that happens, you do get a lot of rich language. I mean, Anna and I are totally kindred spirits here.
Well, and language, I mean, what you're also talking about is a conversation. I mean, even mm-hmm. with a pre-verbal child, a conversation.
Yeah. Believe it or not, even pre-verbal children smile and coo and burp. And you wouldn't believe this. Well, Anna would. But you put an eight-week-old in front of the two of us, and I promised that Anna and I would have a conversation. And you can actually have those conversations, but you have to take the time to look into the fire in their eyes as they're figuring it out. And a conversation isn't a one-way street. It's a back and forth. And it means letting the child speak, mm-hmm. and then you speak, and back and back. And that's why we call it conversational duets. And it turns out that what lives in those conversational duets is the beginning and the basis for language learning.
And for relationships.
And too. For relationships.
That was my conversation with researcher Anna Sosa and Temple University psychologist Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, recorded earlier this year. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from political columnist Ron Fournier and his experience raising a child with Asperger's syndrome. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We conclude our hour on raising children by listening to some of my conversation with longtime journalist Ron Fournier. He discussed the challenges of raising a child with Asperger's syndrome in his book, Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. He joined us to talk about coming to terms with his son's condition and how it changed his ideas of fatherhood. Let's listen. The title of your book has the word love in it. The subtitle has the word expectations. And I think this is something that all parents struggle with. Certainly you struggle with this for yourself and for your son, Tyler.
I never thought of it that way, but the words are linked. We have high expectations for our kids because we love them. We want them to be successful in school. We want them to be successful as adults and find the right mate and be successful on the sporting field if that's what they do, and be as good as they can. Why? Well, partly because we want them to do what we couldn't do. We bring a lot of baggage into parenthood, partly because of the times we're raising them. This is a scary time to be raising kids. So you want them to get ahead in this screwy economy? Boy, you know, they need straight A's. They got to get in the right kindergarten class into the right middle school. The problem is, even though that's based in love, and there's nothing I did with my children, and none of the mistakes I made were rooted in a lack of love, But my effort to try to shape my kids, I often was misshaping them. And I think there's a lot of us who are doing that, that we're putting a lot of pressure on our children and don't realize that, unlike a rubber ball, they don't always bounce back when you put pressure on them.
Well, all parents have dreams for their kids, fantasies about what their child is going to turn into. And as you write in this book, you, you imagine him going to a good college.
Mm-hmm.
You saw him playing sports, something that you did as a kid and loved. And it was pretty clear that he wasn't particularly good in sports. He talked about the bench, and he often got benched, I guess.
He talked about
the happy place. For him, not playing was the place that made him happy.
Yeah, and you know, I found that in a diary that I kept when I was writing the book. And it didn't, when I wrote it down, I didn't realize the significance of it. And it crushed me when I was reading it a couple years later. Yeah, I didn't get it when he was telling me. But 4 or 5 years later, when I'm writing this book, it crushed me to realize, boy, the bench is the last place that I want to be as someone who enjoys sports. And for him, his my happy place was between second and third. His happy place is far as away from the diamond as he can get. And yet I kept making him play. I kept asking him to play. And maybe, you know, that could have been another title of the book. What we should be finding for our children is their happy place, not our happy place.
It sounds like Laurie was, your wife, was the one that thought there something is not right here. Were you oblivious to this?
No, I wasn't oblivious. I knew there was something wrong. But one, I was real busy working, like a lot of us. My focus was on my career, which it shouldn't have been. Although, you know, again, those of us who get our work life out of balance, we're doing it out of love for our kids. But, you know, the big thing was I was afraid to admit that he was different. That's the first chapter in this book. It's the one expectation that we all start with, that we want our kids to be normal. Well, you know what? There's no such thing as a normal kid, thank God. All of our kids are. Matter of fact, all of us are really bad at most things we do. Big secret here, breaking news, you know? And so what makes our kids different, what makes them not normal is actually what makes them special. And I was afraid to admit that with Tyler.
Were you embarrassed by him when he was little?
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of what happened in Bush's Oval Office, right?
Bush could see that. Bush could see, Bush is really good at reading a room. You know, he wasn't the best at reading a country. Bill Clinton was great at reading a country. George Bush reads a room better than anybody I know. And he could tell. And I'd like to say, there's times in the book where I met, you know, I would like to say out loud that I was worried that Tyler would embarrass himself. Well, no, I was worried he was embarrassing me. I was worried that he was wasting the president's time. And what parent hasn't done that? What parent hasn't winced when their kid has said something at a cocktail party or shouted something in a mall or looks a little different or is a little different? And Bush was basically telling me, you know, get over yourself.
So when you got the diagnosis of Asperger's, and it was really your wife that was looking actually at a TV show and, began to think, this child in this TV show is sort of looks like Tyler.
Yeah, it's an amazing show, Parenthood. It was on NBC for years. And one of the characters was a young man who had Asperger's syndrome. And Laurie recognized Tyler and him on the first couple shows. And then by the third or fourth show, there was a young woman who was coming in and giving this character, Max Braverman, teaching him the social skills that for most of us come naturally, things like making eye contact, shaking hands. And Laurie said, you got to watch this show. Now, of course, I was on the road, so I watched 5 or 6 shows starting at midnight. Well, I was alone at the laptop. She was in bed, and I just started crying. I mean, just
because you said that's like my son.
That's my boy. And it was kind of, I say in the book, it was out of fear and relief. I was afraid because, my God, my kid might be whatever this autism thing. And I'd never heard of Asperger's syndrome. That might be Tyler. But it was also kind of a relief. It was, okay, well, maybe now we can help him. Maybe now there's a reason why he's getting bullied in school and doesn't have a lot of friends and is having a hard time getting his brilliant thoughts down on paper. And it's kind of how we've played it ever since with Laurie's leadership, to both me and Tyler and her seizing the label and using it to our advantage in many, many ways. And I recommend parents do that.
What does that mean to Tyler? I mean, if he knows he has Asperger's syndrome, what does that mean to him?
Autism Speaks, which was one of the great organizations dealing with autism, did a video interview with Tyler and I that I recommend people see either on our website, which is lovethatboybook.com, or the Autism Speaks website. And you'll see Tyler's asked that question. He says, first of all, I'm very proud of being autistic. And he says, you know, I have blue eyes. I don't talk about it all the time. I have blue eyes. I have autism. That's it. It's just, to me, it's shrugging his shoulders. He'll tell you, you know, if you've met one Aspie, you've met one Aspie. It doesn't define him, but he's very proud of the fact that that's what he is. And just like, you know, some people are proud that they're left-handed and not right-handed. So he doesn't let it shape him or define him, but he's proud of the label. And I think it helps him. He knows right out when he says what he has, people now know, okay, here's where he stands. It's a way to explain himself, maybe is a better way to put it.
Do you think he was depressed as a little kid? I mean, before it became clear who he was?
No, we know he was. He was clinically depressed. When we got the diagnosis right after Lori saw that show, the doctor told us that he had this thing called Asperger's syndrome, and he was also dealing with depression, and he was isolated. And the doctor told us, if we're not careful, he's, you know, right now he's very lonely, and here's the things that we can do so he can deal with his Asperger's syndrome and not have him drag him further down into a hole. But he was, and we couldn't tell. Now, it's hard to tell with anybody. As a matter of fact, we write in a book about how my older daughter dealt with depression, and we were caught by surprise by that as well. It's especially hard with somebody on the spectrum because somebody like Tyler has empathy and has feelings, including depression. They're just not very good at showing them.
You describe his, I guess, personality or perhaps symptoms. I'm not sure what the right word is. His pseudo-adult intellect, vocabulary and baritone, awkward social interactions and obsessions, his aversion to certain fabrics, the comfort he found in a weighty blanket, and an extraordinarily picky palate.
Yeah, those are all things that we were dealing with when he was young and even kind of enchanted by the fact that he had five food groups, you know, hot dogs, macaroni and cheese.
And that's not so unusual for children.
That's the other thing. You know, and we're still dealing with this. When he's, you know, the other day he was kind of giving his mom a hard time. Well, is that an 18-year-old boy who's pushing away from his mother, or is that an Aspie? It's kind of hard to tell the difference sometimes. So it wasn't until we got the diagnosis and we realized what we were dealing with that we then kind of put all the clues together. Okay, because we were busy dealing with other kids, dealing with a job, because we didn't want to admit he was different, we missed these things, but when we put them all together, okay, he clearly just is. And now here's the plan that Lori can put together to help him help himself.
I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Ron Fournier about his new book, about his son who has Asperger's syndrome, and about how his wife, Lori, suggested that the two of them take some road trips together to learn to be with each other.
Suggested? It wasn't a suggestion. It was an order.
Fair enough. The book is called Love That Boy. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Okay, she didn't suggest. She ordered you. She said, look,
she doesn't make suggestions, right?
Gotcha. But she said, you need to know who your son is.
Literally, walking out of the doctor's office when
this
he was diagnosed.
This is when you got the diagnosis.
He was 12 years old, and this is almost exactly 4 years ago. We're walking out of the doctor's office. We're in the parking lot. And she's got the most big, beautiful eyes you'd ever want to see, and they're filled with tears. And she says, you've got to step up. You got to step up, spend more time with your son, and bond with him, connect with him. And you've got to get him out of the basement and out of this town and out into the world so that these things that we now just learned that we have to teach him, he can practice on people. And in that diagnosis, among the things that she told us was that he was awkward physically, clumsy. And I told the doctor, I asked the doctor, is that why he's no good at sports? And she kind of gave Lori kind of a sideways glance and said, well, yeah, Ron, that's probably why he's not good at sports. It's also probably why he doesn't like them.
A revelation to you?
That was kind of the beginning of my, but it was a revelation to myself. What a selfish guy I am, that here I'm turning his diagnosis into a scouting report. And I'm wondering how this might affect him as the dream that I had, that he would be a jock. And so we get into the car and we're driving away. And by the time we get home, she's come up with the idea that where we were literally going to go were to presidential sites, because the presidency kept me away from the family, my job. And one of Tyler's obsessions, one was animals, the other was history. And by the way, obsessions was a word we had just learned was attached to autism. We just thought it, you know, we just knew it was something he was obsessed
about
by,
things,
right? So off we went. We went to all these wonderful, she called them road trips. I called them guilt trips.
Yeah, guilt trips, because she was saying, you got to step up. You haven't really been here
right. In
the way that Tyler needs you.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, the editor of the book at one point told me, I think Lori was actually also telling you that you had to be a little bit more self-aware, that you had to get over yourself.
Were you nervous, though, or thinking, oh, God, I have to, like, draw? I mean, I'm going to spend all this time with my son in a car driving to all these various presidential homes and museums and libraries?
Yeah, you're going to make me cry here. I was in Baltimore talking about the book to a parenting group up there. And there's a guy at the front, and the whole time I'm talking, he's looking at me like, I thought he was really mad at me. He was really stone-faced and real serious. And when we get to the Q&A, he puts up his hand and he says, I'm taking my son on road trips. And I said, well, congratulations. He says, I don't know what to say. And then he starts crying. Because here's a 40-some-year-old man. I don't know what to say to my son. And I thought, and actually, I told him, that's exactly where I was 4 years ago. I was scared. I kind of liked the idea of going out with him. I love my son very much, always have. And, you know, the idea of being able to, you know, really try to dig in and help him out. But it was kind of scary. And you'll see through the book how hard I tried and how he just kept telling me, would you let up?
Well, exactly. Right. I have to say, you know, Tyler comes across great in this book.
Thank you. Him and Laurie are he's the star. Laurie's the
right.
Hero.
You're the butt of the joke
right,
here,
exactly.
I guess, in a lot of different ways. But he's kind of calling you out as a dad. He's saying, stop trying so hard.
And what he's doing by, you know, without getting into specifics, I would try and he would say, stop trying so hard. But where he would let up was when I finally was doing things right. When I was finally asking the right question, when I was finally helping him get to where he wanted to be instead of where I wanted him to go. So it's kind of subtle, but when you read these guilt trips, you see that he's teaching me how to be a dad.
Yeah. I mean, you're...
Actually, he's teaching me how to be a good man, which is how you become a good dad. Uh-huh. And you know what? Because of the way he's wired, they call it Asperger's syndrome, but it makes him naturally just a good person. He was born a good person. A lot of us have to learn it, but he can't lie. He's got the biggest heart. He's literal and blunt and smart, and it makes him a good person. So he was born ready to be a good dad. He was just kind of, he was teaching me the skills that I lack. I never really thought of it that way.
What's so interesting is Tyler's passion. I mean, his favorite president is Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a great scene of, you know, visiting and talking about Roosevelt. And what's so interesting that I've learned about him more recently from PBS specials and things like that was how much he loved his children.
Yeah, I was surprised, too. You know, he's such a bombastic, over-the-top character.
But he melted when his children were involved.
And you talk about, you know, putting expectations too high. He took a country that was, you know, very insular and parochial and said, you're going to be the greatest country on earth. You know, so I figured he was that kind of father. But when you read the letters to his kids, and Bill Clinton pulled off his bookshelf and gave Tyler a first edition copy of Teddy Roosevelt's letters to his kids, which is how I found out about it. Thank you, Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And he signed it, by the way, from one TR fan to the other, because Teddy Roosevelt's Bill Clinton's favorite president. When you read those letters, you see that he set expectations high for his kids, which we all should do. But he helped his kids get to those goals. They were general goals, and get to them the best way possible. So he would say things like, yeah, I really want you to get a good grade this semester, but don't let it get in the way of your health. Or it's great that you're playing football, and I love that you're playing football, but don't let it get in the way of your grades. So he was actually, if you look at the letters, a model of what I call a Goldilocks parents, a parent. One that's not too permissive and not one that's too authoritative, but right nicely in the middle.
Well, one more president that is also involved in this book is President Obama, Michelle Obama. You're at the White House again with Tyler, waiting in line to shake hands. And Tyler has been practicing on, you know, the social graces.
Right.
And he's worried that he's not going to do you proud.
Yeah, this one kills me. Just as we get up to the front of the line, Tyler looks up at me and says, I hope I don't let you down, Dad.
Yeah. And you had a revelation at that moment, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, because I knew the right answer was there's nothing you can do that would let me down. And I knew that as a father, I should be able to fix it. I should be able to help him with whatever's bothering him. And I couldn't do either one because I was worried that he was going to embarrass himself. No, I was worried that he was going to embarrass me. So instead what happened, he walks up and I grab Barack Obama's hand and hello, Mr. President. And he asked me about my basketball game. We played basketball actually here in Pittsburgh the day of the Pennsylvania primary in 2008 at the YMCA here in town. So he asked me about my basketball game. He knows how bad it is. And I kind of chuckle and I see out of the corner of my eye that Tyler has his arms out and Michelle Obama is wrapping him in the biggest hug like a blanket. Now, for ASPs, contact like that, especially with a stranger, they normally, you know, will shirk away from. Tyler just took that hug and the two of them just hugged like they were mother and daughter. It was the sweetest thing you could ever see. And then he walks over and does just as he had practiced. He grabs the president's hand, even better than I did. Hello, Mr. President. Looked him right in the eyes. And as I turn around and look at the camera for us to get our quick picture taken, I realize at that moment, and this is the first trip we took, that the problem wasn't me. I mean, I'm sorry, that the problem wasn't Tyler, and the problem wasn't autism, that I was the problem. The problem was me, and that I had to figure out how to connect with him better and understand him better and stop being so tied in knots.
That was my conversation with Ron Fournier about his book, Love That Boy, recorded earlier this year. Fournier has since left his post at the National Journal and the Atlantic to focus on the rebuilding efforts taking place in his hometown of Detroit, Michigan. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.